Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Got another great episode for you today. Also, I have a new microphone, so if I sound a little bit different or the sound quality in the introduction is different than the quality from the actual interview that we're going to hear, it's because I got a new microphone that I'm using for the intro and for the outro. So that would be the reason for that. So, and that's another reason why, listen, I need you guys' support, because it takes a little bit of money to put forth these episodes. You know, I have to pay for their storage space to record the episodes and to upload them onto the internet. But like I said, I bought some microphones, trying to have more than one guest on at a time, and all this takes money. So you can help to support the show by going to Venmo, Cash App, or PayPal. All those are CPTL Hunter. You know, $1 episode, $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever you can do to help support the show would be greatly appreciated. It helps just to keep the show going, and I appreciate it. Also, remember the Patreon page, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, and that's patreon.com. Go on over to Captain Hunter's Podcast, search for that. Also, remember to check out the Facebook page. We're going to be uploading some clips of different episodes onto the Facebook page, looking to start discussions. Eventually, want to get into a Book of the Month club, starting off with that. So a lot of good things are going to be coming up. In January 2020, we're going to be looking at doing some selling some merchandise, some t-shirts from both my consulting business, LMH Police Training and Consulting, some t-shirts and mugs from that organization, as well as t-shirts and mugs from Captain Hunter's Podcast, all to support the show and everything like that. So that's what we got going on, and I truly appreciate you guys' love and support. Thank you once again for all that you're doing, and thank you for helping to take this ride along with me and with us in order to make our lives and our communities better. So today's episode, we got a good episode for you today. We got an actual real live emergency room doctor. Sticks his hands in the places where we are so squeamish to go many times. So the reason that I had him on, and we'll talk about this in the episode, but the reason that I wanted to have him on the episode is because the fairly recent, and I mean back in, I'm not sure if it was September or maybe August or so, there was a mass shooting. These are becoming so commonplace now, right? We just had another mass shooting as I record this episode in Florida, I believe at a military base. So, you know, it's just crazy what's going on. But regardless, when I saw the mass shooting or the active shooter situation that was going on in Texas, there was an ER doctor, emergency room doctor, who came on and was talking about the importance of learning BLS, basic life support, basic life-saving skills. He was talking about learning how to control bleeding. And it's very important for civilians and everyday citizens to know just the basic stuff about how to save people's lives. I thought about that. I thought there was a really good information that doctor from Texas was giving out, and I thought to myself, you know, I know a doctor, or at least I have access to an emergency room doctor who taught us as police officers basic control bleeding methods for the police department. I reached out to him, Dr. Scott White, and he was so gracious enough to be on the show. So I'm really looking forward. We had a great conversation. He's very knowledgeable. Obviously, he's been a lot of places, and he has done a lot of things. I'm going to try to get through his bio, but as you can imagine, it is fairly extensive. So I'm just going to kind of briefly go over it. But trust me, he is a real live, authentic emergency room doctor. Our guest today is Dr. Scott White. He has his Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering. He's got a Master's of Science in Biological Services. He's a Doctor of Osteopathy from the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine. That's in Maine. He's emergency room medical doctor, board certified emergency medicine, board certified family practice, advanced cardiac life support instructor, advanced trauma life support instructor, advanced trauma life support provider, basic cardiac life support instructor, pediatric advanced life support instructor, SWAT operator, sniper certification, CQP training, medical license, DEA license, I could go on and on reading from his bio, but what's also very important is he's been on the SWAT teams and had CQP, which is close quarter combat training. So not only is he a medical doctor, but he's the type of medical doctor that you really don't want to mess with. He's also the head coach of the Amity Cheshire High School, North Haven High School's girls hockey team. He owns a construction business. He's the president owner of White House Family Builders and Construction. He also plays in the Men's Hockey League. He's the head coach of the Amity High Girls Ice Hockey Team. He's got a black belt in Taekwondo. He enjoys skiing, rock climbing, guitar, fine woodworking, men's lacrosse, and triathlons. His bio is extremely extensively long. When I talked to Judge Owens, her bio was also extensively long and large and everything like that. You know, with doing woodworking and running triathlons and being trained and all the numerad of ideas, numerous disciplines that he has, a black belt in Taekwondo and all this kind of stuff. When do these people find time to sleep? I mean, it's just crazy. So, but also, that should be an inspiration to you, right? If these people who are ordinary citizens, right, they put their pants on one leg at a time, if you will, from Judge Owens to Dr. White, if they can do it, if they can find the time to make their dreams and hopes and desires come true, then you should be able to find the time to make your dreams, hopes, and desires to come true as well. So that's just a little bit about their bio. I'm going to let Dr. White explain more about himself. Today, we're going to talk about why you should learn and why your family members should learn CPR, BLS, basic life support, methods to control bleeding, because we're all only one accident away from some tragedy happening in our backyard or some tragedy happening around the house. We have children, we have our loved ones, our cousins, our nieces, our nephews, our parents, and you ought to know what to do and how to handle an emergency situation, right? As we'll talk about in the episode, if those situations come up and you freeze, and you don't know what to do and you don't do anything, if you are a normal, decent human being, then you should feel some type of way, right? Some guilt mechanisms to click within your heart and within your mind saying you should have done more. So this is your opportunity to be encouraged today to do more, to learn more. That way you can be a better asset in your community, right? Sound good? Sounds good. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview with Dr. Scott White. Dr. Scott White, thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you so much. The reason I wanted to have you on is because with the last, I think it was the last shooting, major shooting event, even though it wasn't really kind of a mass shooting in the way that we think about mass shootings, is I think it was a situation in Texas where the guy was running away from the police in his vehicle and there was some kind of shootout. Forgive me, my memory is kind of sketchy about the events. But what I remember is that there was a doctor who was given an update on the people who were shot. And he, during his update that he was giving, he was reminding everyone to learn CPR, BLS. Now, I know what that means, basic life-saving skills and all that kind of stuff. So, and I thought that was very nice of him, for lack of a better term, to say that everyone ought to learn this kind of stuff in case we are in a situation, whether it's a mass shooter or if it's just, some accident that happens in the backyard, that we should learn these kind of life-saving skills. And I thought about my own training, a class that I had recently taken. Now, just to give the audience a little bit of background, I retired February 2019 from the Waterbury Police Department. The Waterbury Police Department was so kind enough that when my certification was about to expire for CPR and to be a first responder, they allowed me to recertify. And I believe it was in April or May that I was allowed to sit in the class. Once again, I brag about the Waterbury Police Department all the time. So I really appreciate them letting me sit through this certification. And so you were the instructor of the class, of the basic, one of the classes, it's a 3-day class. You were an instructor in one of the blocks of hours. And you talked about this BLS, life-saving skills, gun wounds and things like that, gunshot wound control, bleeding methods and things like that. So that's the reason I wanted to have you on. So I'm looking at this doctor on the TV and said, oh man, you know, we got our own doctor in our own backyard. Why don't I have him on to talk about what we all can learn, whether you're law enforcement or not. And how to control bleeding, CPR, Heimlich maneuver, whatever we can do to save the life of a person. So once again, I thank you for coming on. That's the reason why I wanted to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you bringing me on. So as you mentioned, I was instructing. It's something I do every month with Waterbury, but with some other police organizations, because those folks are always putting their lives on the line, risk for very consequential injuries, and bleeding control is kind of a passion of mine. But as you said, over and beyond that, everyone should definitely learn CPR, first aid, simple sorts of things. My wife told my kids from a very young age that she wanted them to have CPR, first aid, all that, because you never know when there's going to be an injury. It doesn't have to be a mass shooting or a Boston Marathon bombing. It can be the kitchen knife wound when you're carving the Thanksgiving dinner, or mowing the lawn, cutting the hedges, whatever it might be. So 100% agree with what you're saying as far as it's valuable for people to have these skills. I'd like to, if it's all right, just sort of give something I say in a lot of my lectures for the folks listening to the podcast that I think most people would agree with. For me, there's three types of people in the world. There's the ones where there's an accident, something terrible happening going on, and they'll freeze, not sure what to do. There's the person that will sort of get hysterical, get agitated, start running around, not sure what to do, distracting, etc. And then finally, there's a third person that will step up and say, I can do something. So what I try and advocate folks to do when I'm speaking or talking about these different topics is, we want you, when you walk away from whatever it is we're learning about, to be the person that steps up and makes a difference. In most instances, whatever you try to do is going to have a positive effect. It's unlikely to have a negative effect unless you're doing something way out of the scope of what you learned. And you're always going to walk away feeling better that you did something, even if the outcome isn't what you hoped for, than walking away and saying in retrospect, gee, I wish I had done X or Y. So I'm not sure what the doctor in Texas had said, but I 100% agree with what he had to say.
Yes, yes. Yes, and I appreciate that. He was very profound. And of course, it was my own law enforcement background that really kind of had me hone in on it. But the fact that he said everyone should learn this type of thing was very important. And I agree with that 100%, as I'm sure that you do. So would you please tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
All right, I'll try and summarize briefly. I had sort of a circuitous route to get to where I am. I'm currently working as have been for about 20 plus years, emergency physician, level 2 trauma center locally. I assist the local police department, our local SWAT ERT team, with medical control and education. But stepping back, my undergrad was actually in mechanical engineering, and then I was doing some building while I was going to get my master's degree to become qualified to apply for med school. Life took a few turns. My original sort of exposure was in mid-70s as a medic to learn some basic life-saving skills. So circuitous route, but in the end, it's ended up, for me, very satisfying in that working with a great group of people in our community, great doctors at the facility I'm at, taking care of all walks of life. But as you know, we get a eclectic, diverse group of problems coming into the ER based on what's going on in the community. And then after that, being allowed to work with all of our brothers, sisters in blue, and helping to take care of them, helping to educate, I have to say, has been probably the most rewarding thing I've done in my life. It's an honor to be with people that are willing to hang it out on the line every day and not always be guaranteed safety. And I say that about our police, but that's really anyone in uniform, whether you're EMS, fire, military, whatever you're doing to step up to help the public, my accolades to you for doing what you're doing, because unfortunately our society seems to be changing and not everyone appreciates what you're doing, and you're often putting your life at risk out there. And so anything I can do to sort of help mitigate that risk or have a positive outcome, even if there is bad interaction, that's my driving force, and I believe that's your driving force, and hopefully everyone that's involved in education and trying to be proactive in making differences in people's lives, that's what we're out there trying to do.
Absolutely. Can you tell us what a level 2 trauma center is? What does that mean?
So a level 1 trauma center, working backwards, would be your academic institutions, so regionally, Yale, Hartford, moving to different areas of the country. It'll usually be your large teaching institutions that has every specialty available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Level 2 trauma will generally have all the specialties, but they may share some of the specialties with other regional facilities. A level 3, not all the specialties available. And then after that, non-designated facilities where sort of remote access, limited access types of facilities exist. Sort of more reversed order from the military, which goes opposite of that as far as, number of coordination doesn't coordinate with the level of care being rendered. So I don't know if that makes sense, but if you're a role 1 and you're out in the middle of nowhere, you're getting a doc and a medic possibly working on you until you move up the chain and into your final destination to get your medical care.
Very good. So that's why sometimes, depending on the nature of the injury, right, someone can start off in one hospital and they'll be shipped to another hospital that they have more expertise, essentially.
Correct. Or they may have special machinery that's not available or more current types of machinery. And not to say that any one particular level trauma center can't do something very well and that someone's injured. I need to go to the local level 1, which is an hour away because that's where the best care is. That's not generally the case at all. Obviously, if you have some unusual illness or a disease and you need something not available, then it's appropriate to be transferred to the next facility. But in most cases, getting stabilized wherever is closest is going to be your best bet, because especially with traumas, the golden hour of trauma is getting taken care of immediately as much as you can, as quickly as you can, stabilized, and then either admitted to that facility or transferred to the next level of care. And again, a lot depending on where you are. So if you're in the middle of nowhere and there's, you know, one doc taking care of all the people in the community, you probably need to be transferred if you've been severely injured or severely ill.
Very good. So let's get into it. So let's talk about what BLS is. Basic life saving, right? Is that, am I right in that?
Basic life support, yes. For BLS, we're talking about predominantly CPR. And CPR been around for quite a while. American Heart Association is the predominant organization dictating who's certified, how to certify, those types of things. Again, I encourage everyone to get this. This is something that you can actually do online now. So if you just Google CPR or American Heart Association, you can do a lot of it online. I still encourage people, you know, getting on a mannequin and doing those sorts of things, especially if they've not ever had that sort of training ever. Something to be said about looking at a picture versus putting your hands on something and actually doing it.
I would agree with that. That sounds crazy to me, yeah. But whatever.
Yeah, things change a little bit as far as recommendations, number of compressions to breath, all this sort of thing. We've been doing it for about 40 years. And one thing I'd say is for people, if you can't remember, is it 30 to 2 or 15 to 2? Is it one compression, one breath? If you're there trying to do your best, don't get bogged down in the number of repetitions and how many breaths, how many compressions. Obviously, that's very important. I don't want to downplay that because these are all backed up by studies looking at survivability on who's had CDR, with number of compressions, breath, those sorts of things. But just get down and start doing something to make that difference. And with CPR, most of these type of programs will have their own acronyms, ABC being the acronym for CPR, or airway breathing circulation. So potentially someone's on the ground and as simple as opening their airway up can save their life. Are they breathing? There was a tendency to sort of move away from CPR involving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation because of the fear for acquiring HIV, hepatitis, these other things by direct body fluid contact. I would say the likelihood of you acquiring any of these diseases from performing resuscitative efforts is very small, and the likelihood you'll carry away a scar of not doing anything if you don't try and help someone is far greater than your risk of acquiring the disease. And then finally, circulation, no pulse, they're not breathing, assisting with opening the airway, giving them breaths, and beginning compressions. So currently the recommendation is single provider, you're going to give 30 compressions, 2 breaths, and you want to be doing about 100 compressions per minute. And then 2 rescuer, it's generally 15 to 2. But again, if you're down there and doing it, you can't remember the exact number, the best you can do, the best you can offer at that time is going to be far better than doing nothing at all.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned the communicable diseases. Are there any documented cases where people have caught communicable diseases by performing CPR alone? I know the chances you said are small. Has it happened? Is that really something people should be worried about, not doing anything?
I couldn't speak off the top of my head to that, but a simple Google search of NIH could probably reveal that. Before we came on the air, I wanted to look at, as you may remember, when I talk about bleeding control for the MRT recertification, I tell people not to fear if you're controlling bleeding that you'll get one of these diseases. It's about 0.1%, and I looked the statistics up on the NIH website. As long as your skin's intact, and if this person has hepatitis C, B, HIV, those sorts of things, it's far less than 1% risk of acquiring those diseases. As far as CPR-acquired diseases, I'll plead ignorance that I did not take a look at that, but I'm certainly willing to guess it's in that same realm of 1% or less risk of acquiring that.
No, it's all good. I was just kind of curious. You brought that up, and I don't want people to be afraid of that, you know. So if the chances are slim to none, then I just want people to do that. And I can remember seeing a commercial that was on TV some few months back where it said, we talked about CPR. And basically, it was saying that if you don't know anything, just get down there and start pushing on their chest until help arrives, essentially.
Correct. And as we said before the show, I try not to talk too much about my past traumas as far as reliving them. But I will mention one that some folks may remember from, I can't remember the year, but mid-2000s, I played men's hockey. And this is down in a local arena. And my defensive partner took a slap shot at the last second of the game, and a young man dove in front of the puck, and the puck hit him. Buzzer goes off. We all line up to shake hands, and happen to look over, and the young man's not getting up. And went over to him, and he's starting to have agonal respirations. So do all the things we just talked about, opening the airway, trying to help him with his breathing, and eventually loses his pulse. And the reason I'm bringing this up is everyone wanted to do something. Doc, what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? So others got down on the ice and, resist for the CPR. He started to have some vomiting. And I said, look, I understand if no one wants to, do the mouth to mouth, I'll do it. I'm not worried. And there wasn't a single person there, including the scorekeeper that actually got on the ice, was doing the mouth to mouth and administering, rendering aid to this young man, even though he's having some pretty gross stuff coming out of his mouth. So it was an eye opener for me that despite talking about it, people will still step up and do the right thing when needed.
Oh, that is
unfortunately, it didn't work out for the best for the young man, but I think we all could at least say we tried our best and that we could sleep a little easier with that, even though Nate, who, believe it or not, was in criminal justice at our local university here, did not have a great outcome. But nonetheless, I know I sleep a little better knowing we try to do everything we could.
Well, I think trying to do the best that we can is the most important thing. So let's get to your passion, your expertise, bleeding control. As we mentioned, somebody's playing outside of the lawnmower, they cut their wrist, or they're a kid running through the house and falls in the dishwasher with the knife sticking up. Talk to us about the essentials of learning what to do with that. How should we handle situations like that? You talked about the golden hour that's with bleeding control. So just talk us through that.
All right. Well, I appreciate that lead in. That was perfect. So it is my passion. And again, a lot has to do with past experiences, but bleeding control is actually a spinoff or part of a larger program called TTRIC or Tactical Combat Casualty Care. And I don't want to go too far out of my lane here, but TTRIC is a program that came about when our military started transitioning from large group troop movements to more special operation forces. And the further they got away from centralized ability to get medical care, what could be done to save a troop's life in order to get to that next level of care? And so tourniquets, packing wounds, airway, pneumothorax, so all these different things are part of this program. And it sort of spun up historically through the 75th Ranger group. And the survival rate for the 75th Ranger group after a short period of time in our global war on terror sort of established that their mortality rate for all different types of wounding was substantially less than the general military, which was still receiving combat lifesaver or various forms of medical education. And even stepping a little further back, historically, most military medicine came about from transitioning what's going on in the civilian population and bringing it to the battlefield. In this instance, it sort of took what was needed in small areas of operations battlefield and translated back to the community. So I kind of gave a brief history. I like history, like I know you do, because I listened to some of your podcasts there and know that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. So as I probably said in my lecture when you took the class, tourniquets are a perfect example. Tourniquets go back to Alexander the Great campaign, where they used a leather strap and some sort of bronze mechanism to work as a tourniquet. When I initially received training, I was shown a tourniquet and said, here, throw it in the garbage. You're going to kill people because you're going to make the arm fall off, and it makes all kinds of bad things that are going to go back to the body and kill people. So tourniquets were one of the largest portions of the sort of remote medicine implementation as I was talking about. And it's been shown to give the greatest amount of life-saving ability for a simple intervention. And as I usually will bring up in lectures, if you know anyone that's had carpal tunnel surgery or you've had carpal tunnel surgery, those people will generally have a tourniquet on while they're asleep during their procedure or regional block. Their arms aren't falling off. They're not dying. So they're in there anywhere from an hour to 3 hours, depending on the surgery, and they're doing just fine. So what I was taught, that I'm going to kill someone in the 1970s, didn't translate to what they were revisiting several decades later. In bleeding control, as I said, it's a spinoff from this sort of T-tri-C. Where it really came into play was the Hartford Consensus, which came out after Sandy Hook. And this is Hartford, Connecticut. I think it was headed by Lentworth Jacobs, who is very involved with the bleeding control group. And it looked at all the different literature out there and what was being taught and where was the biggest bang for the buck that we could teach our first responders, community, to have the greatest impact on saving lives. And so out of that, they looked at the data literature from T-tri-C and stopping bleeding by a long shot far away is the single best thing we could be teaching people besides CPR to try and prevent loss of life. So it takes as little as 3 minutes for someone to bleed out. Again, being willing to do that for something, putting direct pressure on, if you have a tourniquet, using a tourniquet, packing wounds, makes a large difference. Now, again, you mentioned acronyms with the different things that we teach with CPR, ABC, airway breathing circulation, or T-tri-C, or the civilian version, TECC. The acronym MARCH is the predominant driving algorithm for how you assess someone and treat them. So MARCH now takes massive hemorrhage and makes that first, then airway breathing circulation following after that, and hypothermia. So does that make sense? Well, if we think about it, the reason we're doing CPR is we're trying to oxygenate the brain, kidneys, the organs, heart, etc., by giving oxygen with mouth to mouth, stimulating or compressing the heart so that it can pump, but just through our compressions. So if you take the blood out of the heart and out of the blood vessels and you do the best CPR in the world and get the best respirations, the best CPR in the world is not going to save that person unless you've prevented the blood they need to get the oxygen to the brain from bleeding out. So just simplistically, it seems to make sense. And so from this Hartford Consensus and American College of Surgeons and other sanctioning bodies, there's been a large push to get bleeding control out into the general public. So my understanding is it's meant to be from about junior high school on up through whatever, all walks of life. You don't have to have medical education or be some sort of paramedic, anything else. This is meant to be for everyone and anyone. I've taught my family, my in-laws, people with no medical experience, bleeding control. It doesn't take a long time to get through the course. There's generally courses in all states and different organizations putting them on. Most of them are free. As I said and how we met, I do it every month for our local Waterbury Police Department, who brings in police from different areas of Connecticut and elsewhere. And I was fortunate enough to have received an honor from the city that an officer who came across someone that was shot put a tourniquet on quickly and essentially saved the individual's life. Since that, somewhere in the 10 to 12 range, Waterbury police officers have applied tourniquets and made most likely life-saving interventions on someone's behalf so that they could get to the hospital in order to receive the next level of care and ultimately make it home to their families, which for me, for you, for all of us doing this sort of thing is the ultimate goal. Is we want to go home at the end of the day, they want to go home. It's a universal thing that we want to be home. We don't want to die out on the street somewhere or die from something that is potentially preventable. So I'll step off my soapbox here, but I am passionate about this because of past experiences, but I feel that I'm hopefully making a difference, as are all the other educators teaching this type of medicine, with a minimal amount of instruction and tools, you can make a large difference in someone's life. So if you combine bleeding control and CPR, and if you're willing to do even a little more, something like first aid, which goes on to address things like, broken bones, heat loss, hyperthermia, those types of things, you'd have a lot in your wheelhouse to work with, no matter where you are, to make a difference in someone else's life, potentially your own life or your family's life. So I hope that sort of makes sense in where I directed where I wanted to go. We can just go back in March, if you can sort of keep that in your mind. Most people know ABC, but massive hemorrhage without blood, there's no point in trying to do all the other things, because you won't have enough red blood cells to carry the oxygen.
Right. Now, you in the class, and you even mentioned it right now about the red blood cells, and differentiate that quickly for us. I mean, well, not quickly, but as you can, as far as red blood cells, white blood cells. And I also remember you gave an illustration concerning how much blood can be lost. You use the liters, and how much blood does the human body contain, and all that.
All right. So to sort of keep it simple, red blood cells for carrying oxygen and circulating through the lungs, the heart, to oxygenate and go back out and do what they do over and over again to keep oxygen to all the vital organs, tissues in the body. White blood cells, a smaller component of our whole blood, which go after infection, unwanted organisms in our body, and combat illness. And then under that, multiple different sort of subcomponents to whole blood, serum, plasma, and the list is quite long, so I won't try and go through all that.
Yeah.
But red blood cells, the single best thing we can try and keep in the body so that we can make a difference. And that slide set show that you referred to, I've taught a lot of different courses over the years, advanced trauma life support, ACLS, PCLS, all these different things. To me, that slide set, which came from either TECC or TTRIC slide set, was something I wish I had had 20 some odd years ago when I'm trying to teach this stuff. If we think about our Nalgene bottle, which is a liter of water, we should all be drinking a couple of those a day. It was always hard for me to picture how much blood loss equated to so much percentage hemorrhage, those sorts of things. So if we look at that slide that you're referring to, and we're trying to do a visual here without the actual visual, if you've got five of your Nalgene 1 liter bottle full of blood, that's about the average amount of circulating whole blood volume in average size person's body. From there, we sort of broke it down. How much can you lose before stuff starts to happen? So we looked at half a pint, not much of anything happens. That's about what you give when you go to donate blood. It took to about 2.5 liters, or about half your blood volume, before we'd say, yeah, you're probably not going to survive this. Does that mean absolutely you've lost 2.5, you're done? No. If you've got your tourniquet on, you've lost blood, and you're in a trauma facility or someplace able to administer blood products, things like tranexamic acid and other things, get to an OR, then you can potentially survive. But the biggest point was that 2.5 liters, or half your total blood volume loss, can occur in 3 minutes or less. And when you think about 3 minutes, it's less than the number of commercials on the TV when you're watching the nightly news in one little short advertisement break there. So the reason that becomes important is, if you're standing there not sure if you should do something, and time's going by, at a minute you're a third of the way to bleeding out, 2 minutes, 2/3, et cetera. So as we did in the course, and what we try and emphasize is getting the tourniquet on as quickly as possible to truncate the large vessel bleeding, packing the wounds, holding pressure to promote the body's ability to coagulate the vessels that are bleeding within that wound, and then pressure dressing over that, and then getting to the next level of care. But again, going back to the class, I tried to give examples, the Boston Marathon and Las Vegas and all those other things. For our level two trauma center, the equivalent existed in Las Vegas with the Mandalay Bay shooting, and there was about 150 or more victims that were shot that went to local trauma center, which was essentially equivalent to what we have locally. For me, as a physician, if there's one, two, three of us on in the facility at that time, you physically cannot take care of 150 people that are critically wounded or even extremity wound, which doesn't seem critical, but can be. So it's incumbent upon the general population to step up and help. And we see this time in, time again, on these sort of mass casualty events, that people will step up because they want to do something, even if they don't know what to do, they try. And so the more we educate our general public to stop the bleeding so that they can get to the whatever level trauma center or even regional hospital so that they get the next level of care, the better off we'll be. So going back again to stopthebleed.org and bleeding control, if we're educating our school children on up to learn how to recognize control bleeding, we're more likely to have a well-educated population that can help. It doesn't have to be mass shootings. It could be, as you said, falling the dishwasher with a knife up or the lawnmower accident, or you come across the motor vehicle accident where they're bleeding from their leg that's been broken. It doesn't have to be a mass casualty scenario that you are making a difference. I have a friend that recently he did residency with me, and he took the BCON course, obviously already knew how to control bleeding and whatnot, but took it just to be a part with his family. And he was in the course and he said, when did it become the new normal that mass shootings are the new normal? And my sort of comeback to that was, well, we're blasted from the news with all these shootings. And so that's the focus. But the actual reason we're learning this isn't for the mass shootings, but just anyone that has bleeding. So although the mass shooting gets the public out and wants to learn, it's the minority that are going to be involved with a mass casualty type of incident and still be able to use these skills.
Absolutely.
I don't know if that makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree.
And as I said in the class, and I tend to say in every class, maybe some of my drive is that when I'm teaching this, that maybe you're going to save me and I get to go home at night. So it's not just for the general public, but it's for myself and my family that I hope people know all this.
Yeah, I do too. I really do. And you're right. The more that each of us learns, then the greater the chance that we all get to survive and all get to go home because somebody else will know. So I agree with that. I hope that someone out there has listened to this and decides to take up CPR, basic life support. I guess we can go online now and learn a lot of this. Can you give us some websites, or somebody may be listening in California, where can they go to learn about this type of training?
So multiple different areas to be able to look. Obviously, we all have our Google that we jump on. And so I just type BLS in. American Red Cross comes up first, basic life support, and 2-year certification class. And then there's multiple others under that, cpr.heart.org, et cetera, et cetera. Other sorts of things are your local hospitals. A lot of hospitals will host community education sessions for CPR and basic first aid, those types of things. If I encourage people that are interested in learning more than just the basics, most of our communities are staffed, or EMS, with volunteers. And historically, we've lost a lot of volunteers and less are signing up to learn EMS skills or EMT skills. But I can say I drive past one of my towns going to work, and they have a class every year to 2 years where they're looking for volunteers, and they educate you for free on all of this. And they just ask in return volunteer hours to ride with your local ambulance and make a difference in your community. So Google, American Red Cross, your local hospital, your local EMS. Some of these organizations will also put on CPR. If you're wanting to learn and you can't find any sort of program in your area or something that works with your schedule, then in most instances, there'll be a director for emergency services at your local hospital. You can reach out to your local hospital and say, hey, could I speak to whoever's director of EMS? I'd like to get some information where my friends and I can go to take a course. But luckily we live in a day and age now where everything is available at our fingertips here. So simple search on your phone or on your computer should get you to where you need to be. The other thing that I would encourage is, you know, AED or automated external defibrillator is generally part of CPR now. It's another valuable tool. It doesn't require a lot to sort of learn. Nowadays, you open it up and it kind of tells you what to do. But having a defibrillator in place for someone that's in a fatal heart rhythm will potentially save their lives. And that's one of those other things that you can't wait half an hour for the ambulance to come and take you to the hospital before we discover the rhythm and cardiovert them. You can make a difference right then and there and save their life by administering a shock to get them out of the potentially life-threatening fatal arrhythmia.
That is very important, very near and dear to my heart, almost literally. I don't know if you know this, but I actually had triple bypass last July, been a year now.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Yeah, so yeah. I didn't have any cardiac event. I was just kind of feeling funny, went to the doctor, and they were able to do everything. I ended up getting rushed into emergency surgery. But I would certainly recommend all of these types of things, including learning how to use an AED. They're in malls, they're in bathrooms all over the place. So just grab it and just do what you got to do if you see someone down. So it would have saved my life if I had gone through a cardiac event. Fortunately, I didn't. But I think all of this is definitely important.
I'm glad to hear you're doing well from that. That's great. They picked it up before you had the event.
Yeah, it was that was pretty scary, actually. And when you talk about the trauma in the past, I actually still have, even though I never had an event, I still have almost flashbacks as to what could have been, if that makes any sense. You know, I constantly think about that. So,
totally. You have family. You want to go home to them, and ending up on the floor and not waking up is something that's inevitable, but hopefully not too soon.
Yeah,
we all want to live a long, healthy life. So I'm glad to hear you're doing okay. Hopefully you're out there doing your exercise and doing everything with your medicines. And
I am. I take my medicines.
Smoking.
Yeah, I don't smoke. I'm down a few pounds. I am exercising. Matter of fact, when we get off, I'm going to, when we finish this recording, I'm going to go for my daily walk. I'm doing everything I need to do, watching what I eat and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I am doing it. Yes.
Excellent. If I could throw one thing in there, I just happened to think of, as I mentioned, the hockey player that didn't do so well. I coach our regional girls high school hockey team, and we received a actual AED from an organization that supplies it to people that are doing different types of things where it could potentially make a difference. And so that goes to all the games and practices. Big believer in having them right there. And so what I will say to our fellow coaches is, hey, when we're going in a new rink, take a look, see where the AED is, because that one traumatic event leads to proactive looking in the future, shall we say.
Yes. Yes. That's actually good advice. That's really good advice. I hope that any coaches out there would certainly do that. First of all, I think that any coach should be mandated to learn all this first aid, CPR, BLS, all this, and as well as learn how to use an AED. And know, and you're right, know where they are. That should be one of the first things you look for when you enter a building, is where's the bathroom, and then where's the AED?
and the hot dog stand, of course.
And the hot dog stand. In that order, all three of those in those orders. So.
But the CIC does mandate that there's annual CPR recertification and AED and all that sort of thing. So as long as the sport requires that certification, then they are getting that. And I will say, for my wheelhouse as far as hockey, USA Hockey and other organizations advocate for all the medical education and CPR, that kind of thing as well. So I do believe that the larger organizations are very cognizant of the importance of what we're talking about here today.
Yeah, I believe that as well. I was out in Tacoma, Washington, where my son is, and he is a referee for their football leagues out there, the high school football leagues. He's almost fresh out of high school himself, but whatever. So he's in the Air Force out there. And so he is, they mandated him to take CPR classes as well, just in case there's some kind of event on the football field. So it's definitely going around, which is great.
Yeah, the more people that know, the more likely we are to have longer lives. It's all good.
Absolutely. Dr. White, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Is there anything that you'd like to say to wrap up? Do you have anything going on? Do you have a blog, a website? Do you have any information that we can follow you on, or Facebook, or anything like that?
Well, I'm over 60, so I have to say my Instagram was set up by my kids. I think I have one or two posts, so that's probably not worth following. But I do have a business with my business partner is a Special Forces Green Beret. He's reserved now, but we formed a company called East Coast Tactical Medicine, or East Coast TACMED. We teach this T-TRI-C, T-E-C-C, LEFR when it was around, which is law enforcement, first responder, casualty care. We teach bleeding control courses. I have to say we've been at it for a while, and much to my wife's chagrin, I'm not making a profit. I haven't even withdrawn the money that I put into it yet. Although we can't give the classes for free, we try and make them as affordable as possible. And my partner, who's still actively involved, totally understands the value of this, has lived this. I see and have lived the value of this. So if anyone is interested in learning additional life-saving skills, we're not training people to be warriors or tacticians or anything else, but how to make a difference in mass casualties. It's applicable, as I said, to individual everyday experiences. So our website is eastcoasttacmed.com. We're on Facebook, East Coast TACMED. So we've had folks from all around the state, all around the country. We've had people come from overseas, and we'll say, well, you know, you're from Sweden. How did you hear about us? Oh, you know, we were looking for this because, you know, this goes on around us, and we're concerned and we want to learn more. We saw your website and it looked like you were doing some great stuff, and it's growing just very slowly. And unfortunately, there always seems to be more interest after one of these on the news incidences happen, which is, we don't want the incidences, but we want people to know how to respond to them.
Yeah, well, that's yeah, you're right. It's good and bad. It's good that you're getting the business, but it's bad about how it's coming about. I certainly get it. So if you want to learn something, visit Dr. White and his group, East Coast TACMED, first, and or go to your local hospital. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Dr. Scott White. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain. It's been a very pleasurable event, and I hope people walk away wanting to learn more.
Yes, thank you. So do I. Okay, we'll talk to you again. Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye.
Well, I certainly hope that you were encouraged today to decide to learn BLS, CPR, how to use a defibrillator, the Heimlich maneuver, whatever. Learn something. That way you can do something and you can be a better asset in your community and in your own home. So thank you to my special guest, Dr. Scott White. And thank you for all of you have done for the law enforcement community and training them. And thank you for coming on the podcast and encouraging us ordinary civilians to learn something. That way we can do something and be a part of the solution and not part of the problem. Please make sure that you head over to my Patreon page. I need your love and I need your support. Remember, you can also support the podcast through Venmo, Cash App, PayPal. All of those are CPTL Hunter. Subscribe to the podcast, rate it, share it, like it. Also, remember to give me some feedback, cptlhunter@gmail.com, cptlhunter@gmail.com. If there is a topic that you want to hear, a special guest that you want to have, just give me the information and I will certainly reach out to them and see if we can get them on the show. And that's it. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, much love and peace. Take care. Bye.